And of course, we're going to take your phone calls this hour with Joshua Warren before we head into open line territory next hour on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Joshua Warren with us. Josh, you've been to a lot of different places, lots of paranormal activity. How would you weigh Puerto Rico compared to these other spots you've been at?
Well, in my experience, it's number one. And that is definitely saying a lot because, you know, I have traveled extensively for the past 20 years. And the reason that I say it's number one here is because you have such a wide, diverse array of paranormal phenomena condensed into a relatively small space. I mean, this island is only 100 miles by 30 miles, and yet you have extreme examples here of ghosts, of UFOs, of psychic phenomena, of cryptozoology, of interdimensional warp type effects. And also things are often extremely visual here. Of course, you've got the fact that in the entire world, there are only 7 year-round bioluminescent bays that glow at night. And 3 of those 7 are right here in Puerto Rico. So you have these natural wonders here like that, that just sort of enhance everything else. And it's odd to me that, you know, as I was mentioning before the break, you have this Puerto Rico Trench, which is the deepest point in the Atlantic Ocean. And yet in the middle of the island, you have mountains that are over 4,000 feet tall. So even geologically speaking, there is this incredible amount of change and diversity here in the structure and the layout of this spot. And I think that is one of the reasons the energy here is so incredibly dynamic and why that this is literally, you know, the center point of the Bermuda Triangle.
That's exciting stuff, Josh. And, you know, you're going to be there, you said, through September, then you're going to be back again. What about the Chupacabra? How often does that come up now?
You know, the Chupacabra story actually does come up, I would say, about once a week. Somebody sees something that may be related to the Chupacabra. And, in fact, the story that I was telling about the small creature that has the glossy black fur, you know, that sort of disappeared, even that could possibly be classified as more of a Chupacabra-type story, because I'm still amazed by how many people only think of the Chupacabra in terms of those sort of mangy coyote stories that come from the southwestern U.S. and don't realize that the Chupacabra stories that originated right here in Puerto Rico describe a far more bizarre creature that has this interdimensional quality, that's able to disappear in the blink of an eye or spirit itself off and zip away up into the sky. And, you know, there are all kinds of sort of aerial phenomena here that seem both organic and inorganic. And in fact, during the break, I've been getting emails from Coast listeners who have been going to look at this UFO picture at joshuapwarren.com. And some have been asking, could this be a bird? You know, could this be an insect? And the problem that I'm having with this is that when you look at this picture, and I understand that the site is getting slammed and you may or may not be able to load it for a little while, but when you look at the picture, the weirdest thing to me is that the body of this thing, it looks, you know, like a saucer, just a classic saucer shape. And the arms, as I put it, that are sort of protruding from either side, do not appear to be attached to the body. And so it almost makes you think that maybe if we are looking at some type of a craft here, that these sort of arm-like projections are, in fact, distortions of light as some type of weird energy field is moving around this central section, as opposed to, you know, viewing these as being like wings on an airplane. And I bring that up because when you look at these stories about the Chupacabra flying off through the air, and you think of the Chupacabra as being an organic thing, but it's able to fly, and then you hear stories about these creatures that are black, and then you have this anomaly, which is a black UFO-looking anomaly there captured in this picture, Well, you know, it makes you wonder, could there be a connection? Is this something that does transcend the nuts and bolts UFOs or the cryptozoology stories and get into some weirder interdimensional territory where we're talking about things that can fly here that may have a living component? And of course, for me, I've always realized that, yes, I can run around with all the equipment and measure electromagnetic fields and electrostatic fields. But when you're going to get out there and talk about this stuff and try to have a conversation about it that other people can relate to, everybody says, look, I got to see it to believe it. And I recently compiled the wildest ghost photos that I have encountered over the past 20 years. And I put them on a website just recently. It's called wildghostphotos.com. And when you go there and you look at all these pictures of ghostly phenomena, and you see just how tangible some of these apparitional forms are, there comes a moment where you sort of realize that what you're looking at here is more than some optical illusion, especially when you have the context of the story and you have the credibility of the witnesses. Yeah. And I think that in Puerto Rico, there has not been enough visual work done here. And my goal is to be one of the first people who sets up good video cameras and other optical recording technology here to get more pictures of all the weird stuff happening here on this island.
Okay, to the phones now we go, east of the Rockies. Smokey is with us somewhere at a rest stop in Iowa. Smokey, go ahead.
Yes, I was stationed in Puerto Rico back in 1972 there. When we were there, we had the Marine Corps, the Air Force, and the Navy. And you were talking about one of those mountains over there. I don't know which one you were talking about, but I was on a little island called Isabella Segunda. And off from that island was a big mountain. And I know that in that mountain there was a large submarine resupply center. And on the island, we used to have a lot of cows for the farmers over there dropping dead. And they used to blame it on the military, but we didn't have nothing to do with it. And I saw a lot of strange stuff over there. So I was wondering if you were familiar with that island, Isabella Segunda there.
Smokey, thanks for your call. And I know about the area called Isabella's. I don't know that I've been to the Laguna there, but that sounds very much like the typical types of stories that you hear, especially from people who are doing exactly what you were talking about, the fishermen who go out there. In fact, the same day I was recently on the water around the Laguna Cartagena with a fisherman, we looked over and we actually saw a periscope sticking up out of the water nearby.
Oh, boy.
And so there's no doubt that there are a lot of submarines that are in this area. And, of course, what makes it even odder, however, is that, you know, Puerto Rico is a territory of the U.S., but it's not a state. And therefore, the laws are very ambiguous here. And that means that it's difficult to sort of hold the government accountable for some of the work that's done here. And I recently was at a little town called Parguera, and I met a police officer there in a restaurant, and we struck up a conversation. And he was telling me about one of these strange bases that's right near there where everything is unmarked, everybody's plain clothes, but they have incredible authority and they can do whatever they want, but nobody seems to know exactly who they're associated with. And this police officer said that one time he was working on a project and he actually needed to go to this base. And he went up to the outskirts of the base and they checked his credentials. They thoroughly checked his vehicle and everything on his person. They let him inside the perimeter, but it wasn't necessary for him to enter any of the buildings, so he didn't. He got there, he exchanged some paperwork with somebody and left, and he said that even after going through all that, he still had no idea what branch of the military or any other organization that this place is affiliated with, but it's some type of U.S. government outpost that has enormous authority here, but is very shadowy. And I'm sure there must be lots of places like that around here. And there are times when you get kind of an eerie feeling when you're running around asking a lot of questions like I've been doing.
Okay, now we go to San Francisco. It's Brenda's turn, west of the Rockies. Brenda, you're on with Joshua Warren.
Yes, good evening, George, and good evening, Josh. It's an interesting subject this evening. I have a couple of questions for you,
sure.
Josh, and that is, before with your travels and the people that you've spoken with about these anomalies, has anyone ever felt sounds, strange sensations and sounds before they see something? And also, with respect to the
Chupacabra?
When you were speaking about this, and I think this is the second time I've heard about this, what came to me was shape-shifting. Has anyone ever mentioned shape-shifting? And also, with respect to strange lights recently, has anyone mentioned anything about Palenque in Mexico? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Thank you.
Well, yeah, thanks, Brenda. Great questions. For one thing, yes, when it comes to the paranormal, there are many different things that people have described over the years as sort of being a tip-off for that person that something paranormal is about to happen. Some people, of course, become very, very cold just before a paranormal occurrence. Some people become very, very hot. Some people get an electrostatic tingle. Some people see colors. Some people will smell an interesting aroma. Especially you'll hear that when it comes to certain types of spirits. For example, there might be a floral smell before somebody encounters a spirit of a woman in a hotel, or there might be a rotten smell before somebody encounters what they think of as an evil demonic energy in some creepy old prison. And it becomes even stranger when you start looking at one of the things that an English researcher named Jenny Randall wrote about, called the Oz factor. And essentially, if you go back and you look at decades of reports from people who have seen UFOs or Bigfoot or ghosts, sometimes they talk about this absolute stillness and silence that they experience just before the paranormal manifestation occurs. And it's usually not something that they always are aware of at the moment that it happens, but it's in retrospect that they realize they had this moment of absolute stillness. And I've often felt that that may be the moment when that person is sort of shifting a little bit out of this dimension and halfway into another. And there comes a point on that boundary where you're neither quite here nor there. And that's why everything is so utterly still and silent and distant for a second. And then, you know, boom, the paranormal thing happens, and then you snap back into this dimension. When it comes to the chupacabra as a shapeshifter, I think you could certainly say that most of these paranormal phenomena are a shape-shifting phenomena, because obviously, you know, ghosts are the obvious ones. You know, they are always these sort of, you know, luminous, hazy, well, not always, but frequently these luminous, hazy, nebulous forms that can look either misty or solid and are partially materialized. But when it comes to things like aliens and chupacabras, we have to realize that we have done a darn good job for hundreds of years as a scientific community of understanding how to document and capture evidence of normal physical biological organisms. We've got satellites all over the place. We've got hunters scouring the woods. We've got, you know, we've done a very good job of finding things. And yet, if we are to accept that there are still beings out there, like the chupacabra, or like Bigfoot, or the Loch Ness Monster, or even aliens for that matter, that are tangible enough for people to believe they are solid at the moment they are seen, but then to sort of vanish or to spirit away into the sky or morph into something else. The only way we can reconcile that actually existing is if we consider them shape-shifting, that they either have a natural ability or have evolved to create technology to manipulate matter and energy, so that physicality itself becomes a very flexible, temporal, transient thing. And if, unless you accept that, you can't really fully place all of these phenomena into the proper context. And as far as your last question there about the location in Mexico, I have done some work in Mexico, but unfortunately, I don't think I'm familiar with that particular spot.
Okay, we've got some time for a few more calls before the break. First-time caller, Jim, truck driving in North Carolina. Hey, Jim, go ahead.
Hey, George. Hey, Mr. Warren. I've got a short story and a question for Mr. Warren.
Sure thing.
I was in Gettysburg a couple weeks ago for the 150th. They have a bridge there called Sachs Bridge. I'm sure he's probably heard of it. I went out one night and I took some pictures and I got some orbs. Well, I went back the next night and there was a group there, and I took some more pictures, you know, to try to get some orbs. But when I got back and looked at the pictures, one of the pictures with the group, there's a man standing there and he's white haired, white beard, but he looks solid. And I was always under the impression that a ghostly figure, you could kind of see through it. So could that have been a ghost?
Well, you know, Jim, I am so glad that you called and brought up this particular question, because, in fact, I have a great ghost photo taken at Sachs Bridge. As a matter of fact, it's posted at wildghostphotos.com. I was just talking about that site earlier. It's a new site, and this is one of the pictures that I selected. The photograph was taken by Dr. Bill Forsten, and you know Bill Forsten, George.
I know him well.
Yeah, okay, so, and we know his credentials are airtight. And Bill was at Gettysburg there at night at Sachs Bridge. And, of course, you know, Bill's a huge Civil War historian. He's written a lot of books about it. And he says it's a very creepy place because that, you know, it was one of those places where the water was just running red with blood. And, yeah, he took a photograph, and he doesn't even really like to talk about it because it still chills him to the bone. And you can see these swirling, misty, ghostly images. But what's so funny is that in many cases at Gettysburg, people do, Jim, see what looks to be a very, very solid, tangible figure. They can't tell a difference between what they're looking at and it being a regular living human until it disappears. And I think that that has to do with perhaps the conditions when the ghost died and how long ago it's been. Because in some cases, if you're talking about a fresh spirit, that is to say one that hasn't been out of the body that long, it may still sort of hold the lines and the form of the body. But if it's been out of the body for a long time, the form can begin to break down and look mistier and foggier. And so that might be one of the reasons that ghosts can either appear very nebulous are very, very distinct.
We're coming back with final phone calls with Joshua Warren before Open Lines on Coast to Coast AM. Well, next hour, Open Lines begin here on Coast to Coast AM. Take a look at Beyond Belief, our television program. You'll enjoy it. And also take a look at all the other incredible videos that are available for you to take a peek at, to download. You get 10 days free. Simply go to coasttocoastam.com, click hosts, and then click the TV button. And there it is. The TV show is called Beyond Belief. Back in a moment. Okay, welcome back to Coast to Coast. Joshua Warren with us. We're going to take your phone calls as well. You do a great service, Josh. Are you getting ready for Halloween? Where are you going to be?
Well, you know, I'm still not certain about that. I may be in Asheville for Halloween, or I may be back here, or I may have to travel for some of the TV projects. So I tell you, anymore, I just kind of take it month by month, and I'm lucky that I have the flexibility to up and travel the way I do. But I've got a lot of great options, and so it's yet to be determined.
You are one busy guy, Josh.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm working on several books right now, and of course these TV projects, and I'm always researching just this, you know, vast arena of paranormal topics, and it really does seem overwhelming because, you know, I often tell people that you can get involved in this field called the paranormal starting in one of many different places. You know, I kind of got in because of my interest with ghosts. For somebody else, it might be UFOs. Somebody else, it might be psychic stuff, or maybe it's angels and demons or whatever. But if you get involved with one of these subjects and you really stick in there long enough and you do diligent research, then you will eventually see that they all do connect with each other. And you will be led on a path that exposes you to each of those different things. And so, you know, even though I started out as just a ghost expert, and a lot of people still know me as that, as you have seen over the years, by following the trail of evidence, I now have been exposed to just about every aspect of this complex world called the paranormal. And it reminds me of that quote by Charles Fort, that you can measure a circle beginning anywhere.
Do you have a favorite paranormal episode in terms of UFOs or the Bigfoot or Chupacabra?
You know, in terms of cryptozoology, I would say that, you know, unfortunately, I have never really seen, I've never seen what I believe to be a real Bigfoot. When I was a kid, I thought I saw something big and dark and hairy in the woods, but I'm not sure about, you know, what that could have been. But I did see a black dog once that was pretty freaky. And these are dogs that some people might consider hellhounds.
Right.
And in fact, the oddest thing about this in general was that I do a radio program called Speaking of Strange. And one evening, this was not too long ago, I think this was last year, I had Nick Redfern on, and we were talking about cryptids. And we had this big, long discussion about the black dogs, the hellhounds, and how that generally they have a tendency to be seen around water. For example, you might see them around bridges. And that when you see them, they can either represent something good or bad that's going to happen. You know, one might be showing up to protect you and guide you if you're a vulnerable person and you're going through a dangerous area. Or one might show up and be an omen of doom, that something bad's about to happen. You know, maybe you're about to die or something along those lines. So I had this big conversation with him on the radio. And after that, I was driving. This was about midnight. I was driving to go meet up with some friends at a local pub. And I was driving on a back road, and I was rolling up to a stop sign. And the road I was riding on intersected with a bridge. And I was not even thinking about this conversation that I've been having with Nick Redfern. And I get close to the bridge, and I realize there's something big and black in the road. And at first I thought, well, is that a dog? That's too big to be a dog. Is that a pig? What is, because this be a, I knew it didn't look like a black bear. So right as I got up close enough and it got in my headlights, the thing started moving off to the side of the road next to the river, and it looked at me, and it had a very fat, kind of stout body with kind of short legs. And its face, though, is what I'll never forget. It had the face of something that I can only describe as looking similar to a bat. Huh. And it had bright eyes that glowed white. It wasn't like the red eyes you hear about. And I just can't explain what this thing was. And then, you know, it disappeared off into the weeds by the river. And you know, was that one of these black dogs or hellhound looking things? I don't know. But as soon as I realized what I'd just been talking about with Nick Redfern, and then I saw that, you know, I got that little chill that ran down my spine, and I was a little worried after that, like, oh, if this is an omen, I hope it's an auspicious one. But, you know, nothing bad happened, so I guess I was okay.
Good. Let's go to the phones. Charles in the state of Washington. Hi, Charles. Good morning.
Hi, George, Josh. It's great to be on with you guys tonight. Josh, I just had two questions, one for Josh and one for George. Joshua, what do you think is in the jar? You see, a friend of mine named Chris, he thinks that in the jar, it kind of looks like a squid. Me, when at first glance, it looked kind of like the skin of a deer. You know, I've seen that aftermath of a deer being skinned when I was at work once. And I mean, I just honestly can't tell what it is. So I was wondering what you were thinking. And for you, George, I was going to ask, have you guys considered having anyone from the Ghost Adventures crew come on your show and talk about ghosts?
Yes. Yes, we have. We may have had them on a long, no, it wasn't that group. But, yeah, we've been kicking that around.
Yeah.
But go ahead, Josh.
All right. Well, Charles, thanks for your question. And by the way, I have actually appeared on Ghost Adventures with Zach and Nick and Aaron. So, and those guys capture some amazing evidence. Okay, when it comes to this thing in the jar, and for those who may just be tuning in, of course, you know, if you go to coasttocoastam.com, you'll see there's a picture of a jar, and there's something disgusting and fleshy that appears to be sort of, I don't want to say floating, but it's kind of smushed down into the bottom of the jar. And now, I got the picture of your alien in a jar, George. Tom sent that to me. And, I mean, that looks kind of like a novelty item, right? Like you would see.
Yeah,
I mean,
you would think.
Yeah, that looks like a little humanoid alien with the big eyes. This thing, however, that's posted on the Coast website, it's just a blob of flesh. And it's frustrating because I just have no way of knowing what is in that jar without opening it up. I mean, obviously, that's probably not entirely true, because if they just gave me enough time to sit down with it and really closely analyze it, even through the jar, I could probably shoot some lasers in there and at least rule out something made of rubber or plastic, you know.
Right. How about some DNA on the thing?
Well, yeah, I mean, I presume that there should be DNA accessible. It is in rubbing alcohol, and I don't know how degrading that would be on some of the DNA sampling that could be done. But, you know, when they say alien, what makes this all very difficult for me is that, for one thing, you know, we have that language barrier. But secondly, because the guy who was sort of championing this thing is dead now, I just don't have a lot of the original story details any more than I gave. So it's one of these kind of shady situations, and I don't mean that to say that, you know, I'm believing that this is some type of a joke or a scam necessarily, right. But that the details are just not very clear. And so I honestly have no way at this point of knowing any more than you do, Charles, but I definitely I intend to pursue this more. And, you know, I think if I just keep going back there and visiting it again and again and again, eventually they'll loosen up and maybe I'll get a little bit more access to the thing.
Right. They may trust you eventually.
Yeah. Huh? Yeah.
Let's go to Winnipeg, Canada. Richard's with us. Hey, Rich. Thanks. Go ahead.
Hey, George. How you doing?
Good.
Hey, Josh. Listen to some of your stories that you were saying when you were in, I believe, South America there. I was just wondering, how much of that do you attribute to the locals trying to bring up tourism? Like, do you suspect that some of the stories that you're seeing and hearing could be just due to local legend to bring in tourism?
You know, that's a really good question. I'm glad that you brought that up in particular, Richard, because this is one of the things that I always point out to people, especially when it comes to Puerto Rico, where I've done most of my research here. My exposure to Central and South America has been much more limited. But when you come here to Puerto Rico and you have extreme paranormal stories all over the place, it is almost shocking, being a capitalistic American entrepreneur, to come here and see that there are virtually no ghost tours, there are no souvenir shops selling T-shirts, mugs, keychains, magnets that have anything to do with UFOs or the Chupacabra or the Bermuda Triangle. I mean, in fact, the very first time I ever came here, like so many people who visit for the first time, it was on a cruise ship. And I just assumed I'd be able to waltz off a cruise ship and buy myself some, you know, Chupacabra souvenirs or something like that. They just don't exist. And as a matter of fact, I myself have thought about making some things like that just to fill that void, because, you know, I have guests that come here and they want that sort of thing. And I find it amazing that you can go all over this island and find people who will tell you these very sincere, detailed, profound stories about witnessing these mind-boggling paranormal phenomena, and yet there is no way whatsoever that I can see that they are capitalizing off of it. I almost think that they should, frankly, but they're not doing it. They're not selling anything, and they're just telling you these stories because, you know, it was that meaningful to them, and I believe that adds an extra level of authenticity to the experiences. And I imagine that if you had a section that was 100 miles by 30 miles, like this island, that was within the boundaries of the continental United States, oh, it'd be like paranormal Disney World. I mean, everywhere you went, there would be, you know, some type of souvenir shop and some kind of tour. But it's just not like that here. It's not a part of the culture.
They don't want anything, do they?
No, as a matter of fact, if anything, most of the people here don't want to talk about it. I mean, I know when I come on coast to coast and I tell all these stories, I make it sound like that it was easy for me to come down here and just start running around being, you know, a reporter and gathering tales, but that is not at all the truth. It took me a long time before I could get people to open up here and start talking to me. I had to start making friends who would vouch for me. And in the beginning, I was sort of confused as to why it was so hard, because I knew that these spooky things were happening on the island, but I didn't know why they didn't want to talk to me. And it turns out that many of the people here, due to especially their religious and cultural background, they believe that when you speak about these paranormal things, that you have a tendency to attract them, to draw them to you. It's sort of like, you know, speak of the devil and he will appear. And they don't want to see this stuff. I mean, even the people who see the UFOs, they tell me that I'm crazy for wanting to see what they saw. Because, you know, they don't have that kind of drive to explore these weird paranormal things like I do. And frankly, I'm not even completely certain why I have that drive. I mean, I could sit here and justify it by talking about, you know, wanting to discover new things and explore, but it really comes down to some sort of a personal passion and some sort of excitement that you get out of seeing these things. But a lot of people around here, they're perfectly content to, you know, lay around on the beach and, you know, have a nice a pina colada, a medallia, you know, and enjoy themselves and not go out there dabbling into these little phantasmagoria and these weird areas that a weirdo like myself delves into.
Okay, let's go to Terry in Central Ontario on the international line. Terry, go ahead.
Hey, Joshua, I'd like to ask you something about the missing bodies.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like you to dispel a theory that went through my head the second I heard the story. Is there any chance this could be an unscrupulous real estate developer who is capitalizing on the local people's feelings about things like this and simply moving the bodies so we can put up, I don't know, a hotel, a subdivision, anything like that?
Well, you know, Terry, it's certainly possible. I mean, supposedly at this point, the authorities claim that they don't have one single lead, that they really don't have any idea what has happened here. And they've looked at a lot of different theories. They've looked at the possibility that maybe the tombs were not being raided for the bodies, but maybe for some of the metal boxes that the bodies were kept in so that those could be scrapped. But
I just mentioned it because money tends to talk down the islands, and that money can go to some very high levels.
Oh, yeah, and it wouldn't be at all surprising if there were some corruption involved in some of the authorities who may be covering something up. I mean, that does happen in the islands. And so, of course, the problem with scrapping the boxes is they haven't found any of the body parts, and there's no reason that the body parts should be gone as well. So there, you know, all theories are on the table, but when I, you know, have talked to people who are familiar with that world uh, of of the magical underground there, the ritualistic underground. They say that the likeliest theory based upon the history of the area is that these bodies are being stolen for that. But now whether or not somebody like a realtor would want to take advantage of that magical culture in order to sort of stack the deck, hey, you know, it's a great plot for a movie, and it's possible, but...
I think it was already done with Poltergeist.
yeah, so who knows, but I would say everybody kind of gives you a nod, wink, wink when you bring it up, like that it's probably some really dark, nasty magic being done.
Speaking of dark and nasty magic, Josh, have you been able to stay away from any evil entities out there?
I think I've done a pretty good job, you know. I mean, over the years, I have certainly gone to places that have been considered dangerous places, places where people become very ill. In the worst case, of course, people drop dead, places where there have been spontaneous fires that break out when you just drive onto the land, you know, places that have a lot of cursed sort of activity. And I don't set out looking for that sort of thing. In fact, you know, people want to send me some wonderful stuff for my Asheville Mystery Museum all the time. But sometimes I say, you know, I just don't want this. If they're trying to send me some knife that was used to murder a family, you know, I don't want that. But on the other hand, if it's a cursed little doll, like, say, Robert the doll.
Continues to come up, believe me.
Yeah, I'm happy to have little dolls. You know, there is a cleansing process that can be done if there's any doubt about some of those energies. And I take that seriously, and I let people handle the cleansing process before it comes in the door. Because my museum is in the basement of the Asheville Masonic Temple, and we got to make sure the energy stays positive there.
Absolutely. Josh, thanks so much. Enjoy the stay in Puerto Rico. I'll be back with Open Lines on Coast to Coast AM.